Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Bob Cremer, Republican Nick Tzitzon, and Barbara Iverson of Columbia College. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios on Chicago's Great West Side, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btbtalk@aol.com. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. That's the audio and video streaming of this broadcast. So if you miss a show on Sunday night and you want to take a look at it at your convenience, feel free to do so at beyondthebeltway.com. Got a number of things we're going to touch base and talk about this evening for the next couple of hours, but we're going to begin with a story that broke in the New York Times. This is about a secret plan devised by the Bush administration, in which Vice President Dick Cheney allegedly concealed it from the members of Congress for over 8 years. Recently, Leon Panetta, the new head of the CIA, found out about it. He has canceled the program, but it has once again raised the issue of what was being done insofar as oversight of the central intelligence agencies in this country in the wake of the attack of September 11, 2001. Senator Dick Durbin, who is the number two man in the United States Senate, Democrat from Illinois, he was on This Week with George Stephanopoulos this week, and he had a comment about what needs to be done to look into this charge against the former vice president.
Checks and balances. There is accountability in our Constitution. The executive branch of government cannot create programs like these programs and keep Congress in the dark. There is a requirement for disclosure. It has to be done in an appropriate way so it doesn't jeopardize our national security. But to have a massive program that is concealed from the leaders in Congress is not only inappropriate, it could be illegal.
So you want the Intelligence Committee to look into this?
Absolutely.
And joining us now is someone who's very close to that committee. He is Bob Cremer. He is our Democrat tonight, our card-carrying progressive liberal Democrat.
Absolutely.
And you're proud of all three of those identification. You are also the husband of Jan Schakowsky, Democrat from Illinois. She is on the House Intelligence Committee, and she chairs the Oversight and Investigations Committee. And she has joined Dick Durbin in calling for an investigation. When did she learn of this program?
Well, I hasten to add, she is scrupulous about not talking about classified briefings to anyone, including me. But she apparently heard about it at the same time that all the other members of the committee did, which was, I believe, on the 24th when he came up to Congress, said, is Leon Panetta the head of the CIA, the new head of the CIA, after he had discovered this program a day earlier and briefed both committees. I don't know anything about the content of the program, but I do understand. There's no question that the previous administration had ordered that it be kept from Congress. Dianne Feinstein is quoted today, the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, is saying that it was Cheney who was the person who made that order. So
now what did Jan Schakowsky also said, that this really underscores some of the characterization of the CIA and their openness and willingness to share information with congressional oversight committees. And Nancy Pelosi, underscores, and Nancy Pelosi took a lot of heat recently when she said basically there had been significant misleading on the part of the CIA. And this report tends to underscore that the CIA has been less than candid with the oversight committee.
That's correct. The National Security Act 1947, when it was amended in the 1960s, made a very explicit requirement, a legal requirement, that they disclose these kind of intelligence activities on one level or the other, either to the gang, what they call the Gang of Eight, the leadership, or to the entire committee, in a timely way, with very, very few exceptions. And the only way, the intelligence community are essentially a secret Congress when it comes to these questions for us. I mean, they pass the budget. Uh, they And the only way they can oversee the CIA is to be told the truth. So this question of being told the truth is really important. And there have been systematic occasions, apparently, when that has not been the case over the last number of years.
Nick Tzitzin is our Republican. Nick, nice to have you with us this evening. It appears that this is another step in an investigation of the CIA into alleged abuses of the Bush administration. Is this something that is going to be politically wise for them to pursue? And as a Republican, how do you feel if your government does something wrong?
Two key words here, Bruce: appears and alleged. There's a chronic problem in Washington, and this is by no means directed at Senator Durbin or Congresswoman Schakowsky or even at Democrats in particular, but this idea that you can govern from the front pages of the New York Times or other mainstream media publications. Look, the facts aren't entirely known about this. They weren't disclosed in the New York Times article. I hate the idea that we rush to the word investigate, particularly when we're talking about—
But there was a CIA report here which did go to Panetta. Now one can question how the specifics of that report were leaked and got published, but there was an internal investigation by the CIA into this matter.
And we've not heard the response from the former vice president's office or anybody who's implicated allegedly misleading or withholding information from Congress. Here's my point, Bruce. I frequently argue with people who say that why do we even bother having leaders in politics? In this case, when it comes to investigating the last administration, you have the president of the United States who says we had to move on and chart a new course and make improvements in the way the government does business. And today, Senator John McCain says on one of the talk shows that he agrees with the president of the United States. So two of the most highly regarded candidates for office, including the incumbent president, say we should move on. I'm inclined to agree with them.
Barbara Iverson also joins us. She is on the journalism faculty of Columbia College. You have a thirst for the truth, but also you're a practical politician yourself. Is it wise to pursue this investigation?
Speaking as a citizen in this case, I think our government was definitely out of balance between the three branches over the past 8 years. And I think we should move on in the sense that I'm not sure we need to, you know, investigate every single person and send hundreds of people to prison. But we need to get at how we got out of balance and put us back into balance.
How realistically, how does any, and we talked about this a couple of weeks ago on this program, how does any member of Congress, how does any president, how do they know they're being told the truth when they're being briefed by the CIA or anyone within the intelligence community, especially if they have something to hide?
That's a good question, especially with some of the problem we've been having with the press lately, and you know that our press is under at least financial difficulties.
Stress,
yes. The transparency movement within the government, I think, can only be good. Now, again, how do we check on that? That's always a question. And I think there's such a puzzling thing, too. If Jan is on this committee, there's things that she can't tell me. I'm her constituent.
Right.
And so then that's almost a built-in kind of undermining of the trust between the voters and their representatives.
Well, it is the search for truth, and the big question is what happens when someone is not telling you the truth? What should we as citizens do? Should we just turn the other cheek and say it's not important, or should we push it to a conclusion and find out who is lying to us? 1-800-723-8289. How hard do you want to come down?
Get the good stuff! Brakes are the most critical safety system on your vehicle. Squealing, grinding, or a squishy brake pedal are warning signs that your brake system needs service. Don't take chances with your brakes. Head to your local Napa Auto Parts store where you'll find great deals on quality brake products you know you can count on. And right now, you can get Valvoline Brake Cleaner and Valvoline Synthetic Brake Fluid for just $2.49 each. Napa. Get the good stuff!
You know, I'd get the interview easily with my resume and everything. And then I'd walk in, and I could just see their expression. They think I'm too old.
This is Andy from Sydney, Ohio.
And a friend just told me, you know, one day, he said, why don't you try coloring your hair? And I said, worth a try. And the very next interview I had, I got the job. It could be coincidence, but I doubt it.
For essential career tips and a free offer, go to justformen.monster.com. That's justformen.monster.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're talking about the allegations that Vice President Cheney, for over 8 years, kept a program secret from members of the Congress, including the Oversight Committee. And when the new CIA Director Leon Panetta learned about it, he didn't stop. He stopped the program on the 23rd of June. It was reported that there was no controversy when he decided to stop the program. There was no one allegedly within the agency that was saying, you know, either we're going to go to hell in a handbasket if you do this, or there will be no effect. So it'll be interesting. We don't know the specifics of the program. Allegedly, it was not about any interrogation method, and it was not about any wireless warrant, you know, wiretaps. So those are two areas, at least according to the published reports, that this program did not include. And it also goes back to, I guess the question is, when you select somebody to be on the Intelligence Committee, without obviously revealing secrets, your wife is on the committee.
Right.
This is one of the coveted committees, I would think, to be on. How was somebody selected for that committee?
Well, in her case, I know the speaker asked her to do it. All of the appointments of in Congress are made by ultimately by the steering and policy committee of the party in mm-hmm. question, in both parties, and in both cases, the leadership really makes final decisions. You know, it's a tough committee to be on, actually, because you have to spend an awful lot of time, and you can't talk to even your staff. There's a staff of the Intelligence Committee about it. And you know, one of the limitations that has been present that they're trying to solve with a new proposal that's on the table now is a lot of times these briefings are kind of quick drive-by affairs, apparently. I mean, they don't have you can't bring staff into the room with you. You can't take anything away. And the ability these guys have to actually exercise oversight requires that they know more, not less. There are very few occasions in the last number of years where members of the committees have divulged secrets that are.
But is it realistic? And this may be one of those job descriptions that defies description, because the people that you're bringing in, the people that you're providing oversight over, obviously know more about the various programs that they are involved in than you do. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you even ask intelligent questions, let alone believe the answers you're getting? Nick, you've spent a lot of time inside the Beltway. What's your reaction?
This is just a raw, you know, nature of the beast type of an issue. How many things come up on the radar screen of a member of Congress on an hourly basis? You know, it's in the hundreds. And frankly, the idea that Congress, frankly, you know, Bruce, I'm uncomfortable talking about the whole thing because, frankly, I don't think we ought to be talking about the whole thing. I think the nature in which the country conducts intelligence is private for a reason. Now, whether or not there's deficiencies in the way that oversight is conducted is an issue for Congress to work out. But in this case, I agree. I think it's a tough lot. I think we were talking off the air about how difficult it's going to be for a director, particularly one who comes in without an intelligence background, but maybe that's even better in this case.
We should mention, by the way, that Representative Peter Hoekstra of Michigan, who was the top Republican on the House committee, he said last week that he believed that Congress would have approved of the program only in the agency and panicky days after 9/11 and 9/12. He said, but not later when cooler heads prevailed. So another question that I would ask of you as both a journalist and as a citizen, if the program worked, we are now learning about it, or we will maybe soon learn about it. If the program worked and everybody is safe and there has not been another attack, so isn't that good?
Well, how do we know the program worked? I think one of the problems is we have so many questions now about things that we were assured were working and were keeping us safe, and we have no real evidence whether they did or did not keep us safe. There's a lot of efforts now in the Obama administration to come up with new tools and completely like 21st century ways of dealing with information overload, with how we organize information. And it might be that this is a good time to look at this whole issue. Maybe there are things that have come up through, you know, electronic communications and through different tools we have now where we could have better approaches to this rather than the same approach that Napoleon would have used.
Well, you know, In the last administration, I don't think there's much question that, as was said earlier, there was an imbalance that developed, a growing imbalance in the direction of secrecy, in the direction of a secret police in the United States. I mean, the kind of intrusion into people's private lives that occurred in the wiretapping programs without warrants, I mean, they were not envisioned in the Constitution for good reason. I mean, the idea is to prevent government from ultimately being able to control people's lives completely. And it's very important that
elected representatives. Although that intrusion had happened in the 70s. There had been an intrusion in the 70s, which was basically allegedly stopped with the last congressional
investigation. With the Church Commission. That's exactly right. And for about 15 years thereafter, there seems to have been a reasonable balance between the intelligence community's activities and oversight. And that changed with George W. Bush, and that's got to be rectified.
By the way, let me just mention, and then, Nick, you want to respond, and then we're going to take some calls. Last week on this program, I announced that this is the we've just begun our 29th year as a broadcast, and so I have begun the process of looking at some of our tapes from many, many years ago. And one tape that I discovered, and this is not only of interest, I think, maybe to a lot of people, because the Church Commission back in 1976 really looked into abuses of the CIA. And again, that name is popping back into the news. But if you were a listener to this program on KBOI in Boise, Idaho, you know that he was a senior United States senator from your state. I discovered interviews that I did with Frank Church in 1976 during the time of his investigations. We're going to take those tapes. We're going to digitize them. We're going to put them on our website because his response to the question and the need for such an investigation in 1976 now I think is something that is once again germane. Nick, you were going to make a point.
Yeah, here's my point, Bruce. I don't think anybody has a problem, and I would include the former vice president in this, although I certainly can't pretend to speak for him. I don't think anybody has a problem with conducting a reasoned and informed discussion about how to best manage the intelligence gathering capabilities of the United States government. If that's what we're after here, then fine. Let's talk about doing that. But let's not pretend for a second when we splash the idea of criminal investigation against Dick Cheney on the front page of the New York Times that that's what we're talking about. We know he's still unpopular, and we know he distracts from some other uncomfortable issues, so that's why we talk about it in those terms. If we want to talk intelligence, let's do that, and let's do it fairly and responsibly and chart a better course for how to do it in the future.
Yeah, but if Dick Cheney instructed the intelligence community not to fulfill its legal obligation to talk to the Congress, he violated the law and needs to be held accountable. To me, the problem is not so much the intelligence community, although what they do for a living is keep secrets.
Right.
The problem is the political leadership that instructed those communities, both the NSA and the CIA and others,
to break the law.
To break the law.
Do you see it that way, Barbara?
And I think that the CIA itself, the rank and file, wasn't comfortable with this because otherwise there would have been more outcry when this came out, like, let's not cancel the program. They were clearly, I would say, relieved to have these things taken off their shoulders and get back to work.
By the way, let me quote and explain what that is. The law requires the president to make sure the intelligence committees are kept fully and currently informed of the intelligence activities of the United States, including any significant anticipated intelligence activity. But the language of the statute as amended, this is the National Security Act of 1947 that Bob referenced a few moments ago, it does leave some leeway for judgment, saying such briefings should be done to the extent consistent with due regard for the protection from unauthorized disclosure of classified information relating to sensitive intelligence sources and methods or other exceptionally sensitive matters. Well, it seems to me, again, Bob, if there are, let's say, 22 members of the committee, and I don't know off the top of my head exactly how many they have, but it's probably in that ballpark. I mean, if you give a briefing to 22 members of any committee, there is bound to be a leak, isn't there?
Well, as you know,
is it the real issue here that they didn't even let the chairman know about this?
They didn't let the chairman. They didn't know the leadership of the Congress. I mean, there's the Gang of Eight, which includes the leadership and the chairs of these and ranking members of these committees on both the House and Senate side that are supposed to be informed of all covert activity of this type. Frankly, I think the proposal that they've made to broaden that number makes a lot of sense because the rest of the committee has to be able to do something about it. You tell them and they can't do anything about it, it doesn't make much difference. These committees, if they're told, can do something. They have the authority of the purse. They have the same kind of oversight that Congress
has. And what about, and then this gets back to the panicky period following September 11th. This is a particular program that allegedly no one in Congress knew about this program.
Right.
But there were controversial programs that were implemented right. in the wake of 9/11. And maybe 2 or 3, 5 years later, they're controversial. And frankly, there are some Democrats who may have taken advantage of – they may have been involved in briefings – and because of the panicky situation involving September 11th, they said, okay, do anything you want. All right, now it's 5 or 6 years later. Now all of a sudden they have the freedom, because there hasn't been an attack, they have the freedom to criticize something that they knew damn well about. And I think that's one of the criticisms of the speaker.
But the more germane problem is they get briefed and there's nothing they can do but send a letter to the president. I mean, you can't. If the committee as a whole is briefed and they decide to take action to curtail a program,
yeah.
or they can do that. The Gang of Eight can't.
Okay, we've got to pause. Nick, sure. We're going to come back to you. I promise we have a lot of callers on the line. 1-800-723-8229 when we come back from Chicago. I'm Bruce Dumont.
I'm a human resources professional.
This is Chet from Sneed's Ferry, North Carolina.
Gray means you're old, period. Long in tooth. I used Just for Men. It makes me perform better.
So we asked, should a guy get rid of his gray with Just for Men?
Absolutely. I'd flat out tell him, guy, you got to do something with your hair. You got to make yourself look younger, because they cannot ask you how old you are.
For essential career tips and a free offer, go to justformen.monster.com. That's justformen.monster.com.
These are tough economic times, so I want you to think about something. Gold. At Goldline is the company you can trust for your gold needs. They've been in business since 1960, so call them today. 877-361-COIN. That's 877-361-COIN. They've been audited from a Big Four accounting firm. Their financials are solid. So call them today for a free investor's kit. 877-361-COIN. You get the free DVD and free shipping on your first order at 877-361-COIN. And remember, goldline.com.
From Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. Thank you very much for joining us this evening. Our liberal Democrat is Bob Creamer. Bob is a longtime political organizer and strategist. He's author of a recent book called Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. It is available on Amazon.com. And you've come up with a seven-point plan, because you think this is a special moment in the history of the American progressive movement, and you're worried that some of the progressives might blow the opportunity.
Well, I'm not worried that progressives would blow the opportunity. I do think this is an extraordinary moment in history. I mean, it may be similar only in recent past to the New Deal. I think we have an opportunity in the next 6 months to fundamentally change a number of the structures of the American political economy in a way that is very helpful to average people, and begins to deal with the problems underlying this current economic disaster, and set in place a foundation for long-term economic growth in the United States that will benefit everybody. So I think it's a big time.
Nick Zitzen also joins us. He is our Republican tonight. He is with the Dykema Law Firm. He's a government policy specialist. Once upon a time, he was a close member of the staff of Mitt Romney when he was a governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Also worked for Tommy Thompson in Washington when he was the head of HHS. And also joining us this evening is Barbara Iverson. She is on the faculty, the journalism faculty of Columbia College Chicago, and she works on a couple of websites. One is called ChicagoTalks.org, which is based with the college, and then you have CurrentBuzz.org. And what would someone find if they went to CurrentBuzz.org?
News about the media and how technology is influencing the media.
And you're a real tech head.
Yes.
Quick question to you before we take calls. In the wake of Sarah Palin's decision not to step down and not seek reelection, the next day, actually about 2 days later, the big story was how what she was saying at the press conference wasn't exactly the same message that she was twittering and putting out on her Facebook. Is she one of the queens of blogging from the conservative right?
I think she's a very naive and newbie in the Twitter world. Tony La Russa was the one that was going to sue Twitter for the fake accounts, and so I think he saved her embarrassment by realizing that would be silly. So she didn't sue over her fake account, and now Twitter will verify your account, so she has a verified account. But it seems to me she's only Twittering out, and a good Twitterer would be talking with other people. And so far, she's only put out Twitters where it's a little statement by her, and she's not doing the reply thing where you show that you're interacting with your followers. And
in your view, as a political device, is Facebook and Twitter, is it just the hot thing for the moment, or do you think it has long-term stability within the political community to organize and to help people get elected and to raise money?
I think tools that that connect us instantly like that are here to stay, whether it's going to be Facebook, that brand, or Twitter. I'm not as sure, although they look pretty strong these days. But I think everybody, once you've had the ability to talk like that, I've been at conferences or places where, you know, you can be trading information. I'm waiting for Twitter to hit like a Mayor Daley press conference where somebody can be Twittering back to the office and say, what's the real budget line there? And then ask the question
really
in real
say?
Time.
Mm-hmm.
And also I'm looking for the elusive alderman or alderman that will start Twittering from council meetings. So when we get that live stream from the council meeting, we as citizens could be Twittering questions to them, and the alderman could be speaking for the public in a very direct way.
Let's go to calls. Let's go to Susan listening to us in Chicago on WLS. You're on the air.
I understand that Eric Holder, our attorney general, will be in charge of this investigation of the Bush administration, and that troubles me because I think he's just a politician. I would like to investigate more certain things in his background, why he pardoned those unrepentant Puerto Rican terrorists in New York at the time Hillary needed the Puerto Rican vote running for senator, why Eric Holder pardoned the fugitive felon Mark Rich when his wife was donating money, political money, to the Clintons. It's all politics.
Weren't some of those questions, didn't they come up during the confirmation process?
I think they did, but I don't think they were investigated enough. Leon Panetta is a politician, Clinton's chief of staff. I think it's a distraction.
Well, don't you want a chief of staff who's a politician? If you're the president of the United States, I would think that would be a plus.
Well, I would like to see Eric Holder be involved in really enforcing the law and not playing politics here. We're looking like a banana republic where we turn around and destroy the previous administration. It's a distraction from the mess in Iran, North Korea, Iraq is unraveling, the economy is a disaster. Let's distract the people.
Well, that's basically what Nick said.
Couldn't have said it better.
All right, we're going to move on. Let's go to Edward, listening to us in Chicago on WLS. You're on the air.
Yeah, good evening. You know, when they had Project Echelon in the 90s, you know, when we had real terrorism going on overseas, I didn't see any Democrats complaining about that. This is just a distraction from the bad economic times that are coming. So what else is new? This president is on call. But
so you know, now, in your case, who do you think is responsible for it, Edward? Who do you think is responsible for changing the subject? Is it the Democrats?
Of course. That's what they're good at.
Well, I got to tell you.
They don't have any. Look at this city and state. I mean, it's a complete joke. And now Washington is running it.
Let's let Bob respond.
I was just going to say, I mean, I know the president wants to focus on the economy, wants to focus on health care, reforming the regulatory process so we don't have another disaster on Wall Street, on creating a circumstance where we have energy independence for the first time. That's where the president's all his political capital is going.
And he can't get the attention of the attorney general?
No, of course he can get the attorney general's attention. I mean, the question of whether attorney or not there should, also be, there should also
though,
be investigations to determine if the law was broken in circumstances of the sort that we were just discussing. You know, we can walk and chew gum at the same time. But the biggest focus of the Democrats in Congress and in the administration is right where it needs to be, the economy, creating a foundation for a strong economy for the future. I mean, things that have been neglected for so long on the one hand, and on the other hand, led us into a huge economic ditch during the last administration.
Nick.
If you think of what's really worked for the Democratic Party in the last election cycle, and I've been resistant for the most part to make it this basic, but really it comes down to the trashing of the Bush administration. Now, look, reasonable people can have a reasonable discussion about the policies of the Bush administration, but ultimately that's what holds Democrat numbers up. It's people who disapprove of the way that George W. Bush handled the presidency. So this is a perfect opportunity, and that's why I think you see the temptation to rush to the newspapers with this story. It's an easy opportunity to bring the Bush-Cheney legacy on national security back into the front page, back into the limelight, and question the manner in which they conducted those affairs. Ultimately, at the end of the day, I think it's foolish. I think that it distracts from a very full plate and a very broad agenda that the president's trying to implement.
But again, to look at who the players are, I mean, Bob is saying that the president, at least the president publicly is saying, hey, I want to look forward. I don't want to look backward. You have the attorney general who says, well, you know, maybe we should look into some things. You have the head of the CIA. He doesn't want to look back because he knows there is potential for some real troop morale problems within the CIA. He's not trying to do it.
I'm thinking
he doesn't want the pictures of, you know, more interrogation. He wants that story to go away because he is a politician, not just that of the CIA.
Here's why it doesn't fly, though. I mean, if you think of the quote that you played at the beginning of this program, the senior senator from Illinois and the political mentor in Washington of the president of the United States, if the president wants to move on, he can pick up the phone and call his mentor and say, hey, stop stoking the fire on this Cheney thing and let's get past it and handle it privately or handle it professionally instead of litigating on the front
page. Wait a second. I mean, Dick Durbin and my wife, Jan Schakowsky, are both very eager to pursue the agenda, the economic agenda of this administration. But they're also eager to make sure that there are consequences when the CIA has lied to Congress because it's a critical national security issue. Now, both of those two things are not inconsistent, and let's be clear. I mean, the content of whatever program has never been disclosed. I mean, the question is simply that there was a program that they lied to the Congress about.
I think we're seeing democracy break out after years of it not being there. We have had an imperial presidency, and whether it was even a presidency or a vice presidency. You know, with a single party controlling things, and now all of a sudden we have legislators, and I think there's Republicans as well as Democrats that are starting to legislate, and that means think independently sometimes. And if our attorney general is thinking for himself and looking at what he's supposed to do, and maybe not taking direct orders from the president, I don't think there's that.
What you also have, and this gets back to something that Bob said initially, and that is if one of your jobs as a member of the Congress is to be on this committee and you are supposed to provide oversight, you've got to believe that the people that are called before your committee are going to tell you the truth. I mean, what happened in the 1970s is there was no oversight. Nobody wanted to ask hardball questions because they didn't want to know. They didn't want to ask. They didn't want to know. They wanted nothing. And then when everything hit the fan, they suddenly became surprised because the American people at that point, or many Americans, and certainly the media, was demanding of the oversight committee, hey, folks, do your job.
Right. And I wonder
with leaks over time, if we were to make a chart and say how many of these intelligence leaks have actually resulted in horrible tragedies or, you know, things hurting the country versus many times when they, in fact, brought in sunlight, made our country work better, made legislation,
well,
you know, the vote might.
What turned the public against the move towards greater transparency in the 70s was the assassination of several CIA station chiefs, and that turned the whole public opinion around. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
I wasn't getting past a certain point with the interviews.
This is Tamar from Washington, D.C.
Gray kind of says, does he have the energy to do the job?
And then Tamar tried Just for Men.
And when I went into the interview, I just went into the interview with a new renewed energy or something, and it was the first time I left the place knowing I had the job.
It really wasn't anything magical or anything, but it was magical to me.
For essential career tips and a free offer, go to justformen.monster.com. That's justformen.monster.com.
These are tough economic times, so I want you to think about something. Gold. At Goldline is the company you can trust for your gold needs. They've been in business since 1960, so call them today. 877-361-COIN. That's 877-361-COIN. They've been audited from a Big Four accounting firm. Their financials are solid, so call them today for a free investor's kit. 877-361-COIN. You get the free DVD and free shipping on your first order at 877-361-COIN. And remember, goldline.com.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. We're going to switch gears in just a moment, but I also want to give you a hint as to what's coming up in the second hour of our broadcast. We're going to have Brian Burrow on. Brian Burrow is the author of the book Public Enemies. Many of you perhaps listening or watching the broadcast this evening have already seen the new Johnny Depp movie called Public Enemies. This is the man that wrote the book on the subject, and it's far more expansive, and it's political. It talks about crime, but it also talks about one of the most interesting periods in American history, certainly the war on crime in the 1930s, when the FBI was engaged in wiretapping. Before the FBI became a household word, they had to build public confidence in doing it. They had to wage war against the crime elements in the United States. They used wiretapping. It's a fascinating story about the intelligence and crime in America. We're going to talk about it with a guy that knows a great deal about it in hour number two. Somebody that knows a great deal about Sarah Palin, who has also been quite a cause celeb in recent days when she announced that she was not seeking re-election and was going to be stepping down as the governor of Alaska, was the man that thrust her onto the national spotlight. That is John McCain. He was on Meet the Press today, and this is what he had to say about Sarah Palin.
But I do know that she will be an effective player on the national stage. And I will say, I have never seen the sustained personal family attacks that were made on Sarah Palin and her family in my life. Carl Cannon has a very interesting piece about the media establishment and the attacks that were made on her, and I'm sure that that had some impact. Charge after ethics charge, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of legal fees. But the fact is, she is very popular with our Republican base. She will be a strong voice.
That was John McCain on Meet the Press today. Nick Tzitzin, you're a Republican. Is Sarah Palin a plus to the Republican Party?
In many respects, she is. And I'll tell you why, Bruce. And this is the best observation maybe I've read about Sarah Palin, and I'm embarrassed to tell you. I can't remember who said it. The question was asked, doesn't stepping down from office in effect remove her from a perch where she can affect change and develop her credentials to be a serious player? And the person responded that not unlike Barack Obama, people who inspire a political following that is somehow outside the bounds of the average don't have to play by the average political bona fides. And I think that that sums up Sarah Palin properly. I think that she brings a lot of people to the table in the Republican Party who frankly are fed up with the Republican Party. And as long as that's true, and as long as those people feel like there's a reason they may not come to vote the next time around, I think she deserves a seat at the table, and I think that her supporters deserve a seat at the table as well.
I want to get Barbara's response to a part of what John McCain said, and that is about the media attacks on Sarah Palin. Do you agree that certainly of the recent public figures that we've had in this country, political public figures, that she probably took a harder hit than just about anybody?
No, I don't agree at all. I did my own little Google search of Sarah Palin good and Sarah Palin bad, and they were about 5-1. And Google, of course, that's not all of the television or the print press, but they were 5-1 for the good side rather than the bad side. So she seems to attract more. I don't think she took more criticism and harassment from the press than Hillary Clinton, for example. And although I was having trouble, I couldn't really think of a way to get a count on that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. To me, that seems like when you go into that office, you have to, you know, if you don't go into the fire, if you, you know, Don't go into the flames if you can't stand the fire. And I think it was Andrea Mitchell said the trouble with Sarah Palin was she didn't know what she didn't know when she got involved. She
wasn't ready for prime time.
No.
She wasn't ready for prime time insofar as the media elite is concerned, or was it more than just the media elite?
Well, all of the media. I mean, I think mommy bloggers, for example, who I don't think are the media elite, were certainly going to be interested in both her own pregnancy and in the issues of her daughter and Levi and the baby. That was, you know, if she didn't see that coming from the ground, you know, of just all the women in America that have children that would be interested, much less all the other things that, you know, have accrued around her.
Bob,
you know, the bottom line is that anyone who watched that 18 minutes of her withdrawal, I would think would be very happy that she is not a heartbeat away from having her finger on the nuclear button.
Let me add something.
Do you agree with that?
Not at all. And I think that the problem here is that we've designed a system in this country whereby we have expectations of how politicians will be introduced to the American people. We have an expectation that a candidate for president or candidate for vice president is going to be able to walk to the stage or sit down in an interview and talk intelligently about every single issue. And 9 times out of 10, the reason that that's true is because they've been briefed in advance for 15 minutes with talking points. So the mistake in Sarah Palin's case, and ultimately why she's viewed unfavorably by the people who view her unfavorably now, is that she was never allowed by the infrastructure that introduced her. She was never allowed to be who she really is, which is somebody who's not up to speed on every single issue, but somebody who brings independent judgment and somebody who brings a unique set of values to the table. Could she have handled the vice presidency with a full cadre of advisors who can prepare her and inform her on issues? I believe she probably could have, but that's neither here nor there. She's got a future in politics, whether we want to admit it or not.
I mean, the problem
I beg to differ on that. I think that what was shown was McCain tried to bolster her, and they gave her 20 or 30 aides. She doesn't or didn't work well with advisors. So even when she was given the chance, again,
That's one of the negative stories you read online.
Well, in the end,
it was actually from some Republican. I mean, maybe they were negative, but people in the McCain campaign.
Bob?
And then also, I looked at things from Wasilla when she ran other campaigns, that she would be friendly to people, and she didn't care whether they were Republicans or Democrats. And then as soon as she sort of got what she needed, then she just left them. She didn't have loyalty. Now, certainly, she's not the only politician that's ever entered America that didn't have loyalty, but I think that's one that'll knock you out.
We will be talking about Sarah Palin on this program for many years to come, is my prediction. This is just one more chapter in that discussion, and I know you're very happy about that. We do have to pause. Bob Kramer has been with us in hour number one, along with Barbara Iverson, along with Nick Zitzen. They will all be back in the next hour, and we're also going to be joined by Brian Burrow. He is the author of Public Enemy. We're going to be talking about the war on crime, the first one that started in 1933 and launched the career of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago.
I had a great idea at work yesterday. So, I gathered my A-team to meet online, using WebEx. I passed the ball
to Carol in Atlanta, and I created some killer graphics. Then, I passed the ball to
Taz in San Jose, because I write the code that makes their ideas work online. Then I passed the ball to
Logan in Cambridge. I'm kind of the keeper of cool. And hey, it was cool.
So now, my idea wasn't just an idea. It was our hot new product line, created by our national development team.
Spread across 3 time zones.
And we couldn't have done it without passing the ball.
Using WebEx, the only way to pass the ball online.
Pass the ball. Get your ideas rolling. Go to WebEx.com and try WebEx free. Just click the radio graphic and enter promo code BONUS to get a free trial and a free retractable VoIP headset. Remember that code, BONUS. WebEx from Cisco, WEBEX.com. Free headsets available while supplies last. Terms and restrictions apply. See website for details.
And now, another reason to switch to GEICO.
Every month, we get lots of letters telling us how much folks like GEICO's claim service. And I quote, "The adjuster assigned to my claim was incredible. He walked me through everything." Then there's this one. GEICO.com is very useful and lets you track your claims. And this. "I filed a claim at 4:15 on Thursday afternoon, and my car was in the shop at 10 a.m. on Friday." And my personal favorite, easy squeezy lemon peasy.
For a free rate quote, visit GEICO.com or call 1-800-947-AUTO.
I'm Felix. I've been doing tattoos for over 15 years. I get people in here who ask me about removing a tattoo they don't want anymore. I've really had nothing to help. And then I discovered Wrecking Balm. It's an easy daily fading system. The darkest, deepest pigments, they easily fade without any discoloring, blemishing, or scarring the skin. Wrecking Balm is really the best thing for tattoo regret.
Call right now, 1-800-507-4221. For your in-home 60-day risk-free trial, that's 1-800-507-4221. That's 1-800-507-4221.
These are tough economic times, so I want you to think about something. Gold. At Goldline is the company you can trust for your gold needs. They've been in business since 1960, so call them today. 877-361-COIN. That's 877-361-COIN. They've been audited from a Big Four accounting firm. Their financials are solid. So call them today for a free investor's kit. 877-361-COIN. You get the free DVD and free shipping on your first order at 877-361-COIN. And remember, goldline.com.
The chemical plant I'd worked at for 12 years shut down, and I was looking for another place to work.
This is Danny from Baton Rouge.
And I think that first impression they get sometimes is a little too old. You know, why should we mess with him?
Then Danny got rid of his gray with Just for Men.
You know, they're not seeing the gray in the mustache, and they're not seeing the gray in the side of my hat. You know, if you feel better about yourself, you're going to feel better about everything else.
For essential career tips and a free offer, go to justformen.monster.com. That's justformen.monster.com.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Bob Cramer, Republican Nick Zitzen, Barbara Iverson of Columbia College in Chicago, and Brian Burrow, author of the book Public Enemies. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the SiriusXM studios in Chicago, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btbtalk@AOL.com. And if you'd like to also listen or watch this program on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. We have been talking about the recent decision by Sarah Palin to step down as governor of Alaska, not seek re-election, and there's been a lot of discussion about her impact on the Republican Party, and we do have lots of callers that want to comment on that. So let us go to Bill in Chicago. He's going to chime in with his opinion. Go ahead, Bill. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Bruce. I love your show. It's a great great intellectual endeavor here, just listening.
Well,
to...
we try. Thank you for saying that.
The thing I really like about Sarah Palin is she has something that almost nobody in Washington or any politician has that I know of today, and that's common sense. That, to me, is probably one of the most important things. Her statements in comparison to Joe Biden are like, you know, night and day. I mean, Joe Biden truly is a scary guy close to the nuclear button. He has no clue. He changes his mind every 10 minutes. He has no compass to follow. Sarah, on the other hand, I believe would surround herself with good advisors and look at these different options and end up doing the right thing, which I don't believe Joe Biden would do. So I'm really enthused with Sarah Palin, and
let me ask you this this question, okay? The question I want to ask is, in the first hour of our broadcast, we were talking about members of the House and Senate Oversight Committee.
Mm-hmm.
And they can only really do their job well if they are aggressively asking questions and are really curious to find out the answers, to make sure that those who come before their committee are telling them the truth or not. I mean, wouldn't you acknowledge that that's one of the things, you know, if you have an oversight committee, isn't that one of the things you would want a member of Congress to do?
Well, normally I do, but when it comes to national security, if you look at the history of the country with Abraham Lincoln had to lock up a number of people in Congress because he couldn't have won the war had he not done that. I think there's, in a historical fashion, we're we're in a unique period of time. If Joe Biden and some of these Democrats, and you look at the history, if they had known anything, they would have leaked it very quickly. You have Leahy, nicknamed Leaky Leahy, because he leaked national defense secrets. It seems like the Democrats just can't wait to leak things. This goes back to the Nixon era. And it's a very scary proposition to have Democrats who know too much.
Well, we also had a situation where, obviously, in the case of the Valerie Plame issue, it looks like leakiness, I don't think, is exclusively a Democratic issue. It happens, I think, both ways. Both parties try to leak things to embarrass the other party. But the only question I ask about that nature is just the curious aspect of it. And I think one of the questions about Sarah Palin is, you know, did she have the curiosity to ask basically the right questions?
Oh, but listen, I thank you. She has common sense.
Common sense is in sort of a short commodity there. We appreciate very much. Thanks very much for joining us. As I mentioned in our last hour, one of the topics that I wanted to discuss in this hour and up until the half-hour point in our broadcast is crime in America. The most popular movie in the country at the moment is Public Enemies. And, you know, you have the old adage about a movie is, yeah, I saw the movie, but I liked the book better. Well, I have read the book by our guest, Brian Burrow, and I can tell you that I really did like the book a lot more than the movie. Brian Burrow joins us. He is the author of Public Enemies. It was a best-selling author book when it came out several years ago. And, again, it deals with America's first war on crime, which started back in the 1930s. And, Brian, thank you for joining us on Beyond the Beltway.
Hey, my pleasure.
One of the things that I want you to focus on right from the get-go, because this is a program that deals with political discussion and political issues, share with my audience the political climate in 1933 and the relationship with the new president, the president FDR, and this fledgling bureaucrat, J. Edgar Hoover, who was trying to create a national police force. How did those two political bedfellows come together?
Well, it was close to the depths of the Great Depression. It was a time when an awful lot of Americans had lost their jobs, had lost their way of life, had lost their homes and their farms. A lot of people were prepared to cheer on people like John Dillinger, like Pretty Boy Floyd, who they felt, rightly or wrongly, mostly wrongly, I think, you know, were outlaws who were prepared to take on the moneyed interests. At the same time, you had J. Edgar Hoover, who at the time was a Washington bureaucrat that no one other than his mother had heard of, frankly. The FBI at that point, remember, was not even the FBI. It was just the BI, the Bureau of Investigation, within the Justice Department. And Hoover was a smart young bureaucrat who was very clearly about to lose his job at the hands of the new Roosevelt administration. And he declared in June 1933, at the end of Roosevelt's 100 days, a new federal war on crime. And that's really what kicked off and threw the FBI into kind of open warfare against the John Dillingers and Machine Gun Kellys of the world. So there was, from the beginning, the war on crime, and this whole period that is defined by the new movie, Public Enemies, a political bent toward all of this. And by and large, the fact that Hoover did so well during the war on crime redounded to the benefit of the Roosevelt administration.
Now, the criminals that you reference in the book and that are mentioned in the movie as well, they had a folklore about them. They had popular support, if you will. But in the journalism of the day, were those criminals being glorified and romanticized by the journalists of the day? And also, how were those same journalists treating those who would become victims, who had been killed by this criminal element?
You know, it's difficult to generalize. Each of the public enemies that we write about in Public Enemies was different. Certainly some of them are what a sociologist would call a social outlaw, meaning the type of outlaw that downtrodden Americans rooted for. And in that class, you'd put John Dillinger and Pretty Boy Floyd. But there were also criminals that were widely vilified. And I would include in that class indiscriminate murderers such as Clyde Barrow and Babyface Nelson. So journalists vilified some, glorified some, and where the government was concerned, they tended to glorify them or vilify them based on their latest exploits. I mean,
Brian, we have to pause. We'll be back in a couple of minutes with Brian Burrow. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We're talking with Brian Burrow, who's joining us from his home, and he is author of the book Public Enemies. In that war on crime, you were talking about what was going on in Washington, D.C., but it was an incident in Kansas City, Missouri, that really captured the national focus on crime in a big way. What happened there?
Yeah, clearly, the FBI, among their few duties at that point, was the recovery of escaped federal prisoners from places like Atlanta and Leavenworth. And they were bringing one back to Kansas City that morning in June 1933, went out of nowhere. Several unknown assassins, their identities still debated, opened fire and killed five men, including an FBI agent, leading Hoover to declare this ambitious war on crime, which ended up lasting for 18 months, and bringing the FBI really for the first time into open warfare against armed criminals, something that they'd never done before.
Now, also, you mentioned Hoover a couple of times, but it was really Hoover's boss, the Attorney General, Mr. Cummings, who was from the state of Connecticut. He was really the mastermind. He was even more aggressive in pushing for a national police force than was young J. Edgar Hoover, was he not?
Well, Cummings, yes, had been involved with those in Roosevelt's kitchen cabinet, including Lewis Howe, in looking at the possibility of some type of federal involvement in a war on crime, beginning with the inauguration. Because keep in mind, at that point, there was no real federal involvement. There was no FBI. If someone wanted to take down criminals, it was largely the job of hick sheriffs and local police departments. So Cummings, working with Lewis Howe and others in the Roosevelt cabinet, clearly saw that Hoover was a possibility, someone that they could throw out along with all the other federal initiatives at that time, that they could throw out against crime. And if this young Hoover and his nascent FBI could actually do something against these name brand criminals, that it might help the Roosevelt administration cement its credibility. And ultimately, of course, that's what happened.
And we should also mention that this is in June of 1933. And in 1933, the President of the United States, the inauguration of the President took place in March, not in January. And earlier that same year, President-elect Roosevelt was in Miami Beach along with the mayor of the city of Chicago, Anton Cermak. And Mayor Cermak was assassinated. Everyone thought that it was going to be for FDR, but I think some historians would suggest that maybe Cermak was really the target of that because he was a mayor of the city of Chicago that was sort of cracking down on organized crime. I'm wondering if you might sort of put the organized criminal war on crime in context with the war on crime involving the bank robbers who had some popular support.
Sure. If you look at the 30s, one of the things that confuses people today most often are the differences between organized crime, if you will, classic mafia-like gangsters, and disorganized crime, which would be the John Dillingers and Bonnie and Clydes, the free agents, freelance bank robbers and kidnappers. There was, by and large, no war on organized crime. There were individuals like Elliot Ness and the IRS who occasionally had a victory against an Al Capone or someone like that. But when Hoover, when J. Edgar Hoover and the Roosevelt administration, you know, declared their ambitious war on crime in June 1933, it was very clear that that was against what you might say the lesser of the two evils. It was against the freelance bank robbers, those who were making all the headlines, and freelance kidnappers. There was no parallel war on organized crime, which after the takedown of Al Capone, basically organized crime existed for the next 20 or 30 years without any type of federal opposition.
And that's been a criticism of the FBI historically, is that they've never been as aggressive in going after organized crime as they have against other criminals, because they were harder to get to. Now,
for whatever reason, you can certainly say that's true up until about 1960. Between 1960 and 2000, you could say that the FBI, working with numerous U.S. attorney's offices,
right,
did more than anyone to dismantle the American mafia.
Right. Once the RICO statute was instituted, I mean, that gave them license to do for organized crime what you're discussing right now, what happened in the 1930s. So as we look at back
right.
in 1933 and 1934, I mean, this was a two-year period of unquestioned aggressiveness on the part of this young agency trying to get a name for itself. It wasn't even called the FBI until after that. But take us through the number of most wanted criminals, the most wanted list that FBI put out. They virtually killed all of them within a relatively short period of time, did they not?
Yeah, this was a period where the FBI went from, as I sometimes said, from 0 to 60 in almost no time at all. At the time that the war on crime was inaugurated in June 1933, keep in mind, the FBI agents by law could not make arrests. If they wanted to make an arrest, they'd find a policeman. And by policy, they couldn't carry guns. And so early on in this war on crime against the Bonnie and Clydes, Pretty Boy Floyd, Babyface Nelson, John Dillinger, you see the FBI time and time again making just calamitous mistakes. They arrest the wrong people. They convict the wrong people. They shoot the wrong people. They kill the wrong people. It really takes the better part of a year before the FBI is actually able to get its act together and begin to put together the type of techniques that we take for granted today, you know, fingerprinting, knowing how to make a stakeout, knowing how to do all sorts of things that we take for granted today.
Now, also, how important was wiretapping? It was a relatively new thing. How widespread was wiretapping in that war on crime?
Not widespread. It was used in many cases. It's hilarious. You can go into the FBI files, and keep in mind the book Public Enemies is based on the actual case files of the FBI from that period, which are used for the first time in the book, and you can see them, individual agents, the top agent in Cleveland, in Chicago, in Indianapolis, asking Hoover, now this wiretapping thing, how exactly does it work, and who do we talk to, and how do we do it? It's hard to point your finger at any particular moment or arrest or conviction that wiretapping sprang from, but it was one of many, many techniques that the FBI discovered during this period and that, of course, they ultimately perfected in the years to come.
What was the relationship between organized crime, and again, we do this program from Chicago, where Frank Nitti had replaced Al Capone as the head of the mob in Chicago. What was the relationship between organized crime and the young bank robbers that were making their way across the Midwest and Southwest?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of people ask that because they can't figure out what did Frank Nitti and Al Capone have to do with the John Dillingers of the world. By and large, organized crime, there were many more people involved. I mean, there was a real infrastructure there. And in the early days, the Dillingers, the Pretty Boy Floyds, could count on organized crime to give them safe haven, to sell them guns, to do things for them. As the war on crime progressed, that became less apparent. and you see the so-called public enemies, the Dillingers, Babyface Nelson, and others become fearful of organized crime. Babyface Nelson wouldn't even go into Chicago at the end of his career because he was scared that Frank Nitti's mob would wipe him out.
Well, in the movie, it suggests that it was the mob that may have really dropped the dime on Dillinger. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'd say that's informed speculation, but it must remain at this point speculation because it hasn't been proven.
One last thing. I know you've got to go in a couple of minutes with another appointment, but again, one of the other significant things about this is that J. Edgar Hoover, once those top 10 were killed by the federal agents, he was aggressive in going after anyone who harbored or aided and abetted them in any way.
That's exactly right. One of the things you see about the war on crime is it was made possible. The criminals, their longevity was made possible by places like St. Paul, Minnesota, and Hot Springs, Arkansas. There were essentially open cities where criminals like this could be safe. And one of the things that Hoover did was crack down and end those practices in a decisive way that made a real difference on this type of crime.
Barbara Iverson of Columbia College is here. She's got a quick question for you. Barbara?
Well, I was just wondering... In the movie, they had the scene with the that backroom bookmaking and that the
right.
organized crime was into that. And I was recently visiting the FBI headquarters, and right. they were talking about the modern mafia setting up hacker networks and that. And I was wondering if you thought that was a parallel kind of a situation.
Well, if it exists today, certainly that would be a parallel situation. But what you see in the movie, that's very real at that point. Organized crime was moving away from individual crime towards systemic crime, and they became much bigger as a result.
Listen, on that note, I want to just say, Brian, I really appreciate your joining us. Brian Burrow is the guest. He's joining us from his home. He is author of the best-selling book, Public Enemies, upon which the new Johnny Depp movie is based. I can tell you, I've seen the movie. I've read the book. Go get the book. It is not only a book about crime. It's a book about American political history, the relationship of FDR, the growth and the building up of the FBI. It's a fascinating story about one of the great and most interesting times in the 20th century history. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Bob Creamer is here. We introduce him. He is our liberal Democrat, and our conservative or moderate Republican is Nick Zitzen. And Barbara Iverson, who had a question for our guest, also joins us. She is on the journalism faculty of Columbia College in Chicago, and she has two websites. One is chicagotalks.org, which gets more people involved and sort of it really localizes. It's sort of micro journalism. And also currentbuzz.org is her take on media related issues. We've been talking about Sarah Palin on the broadcast. We've been talking about the CIA. And in the last 20 minutes, we've been talking about a crime in America and a movie that a lot of you have seen, The Public Enemies. But as I said, the book is much more interesting than the movie. Let me talk about glamorization, because one of the issues that came out about this, and certainly Brian alluded to it, is whether or not our movies tend to glorify the misfits, to glorify those that create crime as opposed to those who fight crime. Nick?
Yeah, I'm reminded of a story that happened when I lived inside the Beltway. And something like this really only happens in Washington. A friend asked me to bring somebody up to speed about politics, and I walked into a restaurant. It was James Gandolfini from The Sopranos. Frankly, that's the connection I'd make here, whether it's The Sopranos talking about organized crime or Public Enemies. You know, you talk to people on the street and ask them if they watch the evening news, and people will tell you that it's mostly just theft, murder, and drugs, and that they don't like watching the evening news. But at the same time, you get a movie like Public Enemies and the book written by Brian or The Sopranos. People are fascinated by the dynamics that goes into it. So I'm not sure if it's so much an issue of glamorization, although in some cases it is, as much as it is a fascination on the part of the American people about what goes into making American criminals. It's just a fascinating dynamic.
Bob? You know, but within this particular context is the difference that these people were glamorized partially because they were Robin Hood-type figures in a lot of people's minds because the banks had so failed the country in the 1930s, right in that time, much in the same way that the Wall Street banks have done it today.
Right.
People thought, well, gee whiz, if these guys will take these banks on or if they'll take this money from these rich people who ruined our lives, then we're rooting for them.
Well, they're also – I mean, I'm interested in the similarity between that time because, as I said during the break, I think 1933 is one of the most interesting years in the 20th century. 1968, within the memory of most people watching or listening to the show, they remember what a cataclysmic year 1968 was. I look at 1933. We talk about, yeah, you know, the attempt on FDR's life. Then FDR is sworn in, and then there's the introduction of the New Deal, and then there's this massacre coming in July, and then literally 1 year from that time, Dillinger is shot, and the top 10 most wanted people in America are all shot and killed by this fledgling agency that becomes the behemoth called the FBI. I mean, and all this is going on when there are breadlines, when people are trying to, you know, find a way to survive.
Well, and it is interesting that the kind of this Robin Hood-esque kind of thing that Roosevelt wrote in the presidency on had this other strain of, as Brian said, here comes Hoover, goes after these guys, and that redounds to the benefit of Roosevelt as well. So
because Roosevelt wanted to centralize. His part of his act was he wanted to centralize things, and part of the centralization was the need to centralize crime fighting because so many police departments were inept or corrupt. And they weren't armed to do battle with the criminal element. One of the things they talked about in the book and in the movie was the fact that it was the criminal element that had the V8 cars. They literally outran the police departments who were still cranking up their Model Ts because they didn't have the money to compete, and that was, you know, in creating what's brilliantly done in this book is the word pictures that create life in the 1930s, and the American people, they thought they had someone that they could, you know, that was speaking for them. That's why I was very interested in you don't. At least when you talk about the romanticism of the 1930s, you don't read the stories of the bank guards who were killed,
That's right. The police officers who were killed.
There weren't many, and a lot of them were innocent.
Yeah, it was an infrastructure question, too. I mean, that was the highway. We talk about the information highway now and how it's transforming our lives. So, you know, again, the government was and everybody was trying to react to the fact that, you know, in the movies like the Bonnie and Clyde, where they get to the state line and the right. law enforcement couldn't were stopped by the state there, yeah. line. And, yeah. I mean, that's similar to legislative things that we have now with the Internet, where there's a rule that made real good sense 50 years ago, and it's kind of like, why do we have that
It's
now?
Also one of the things is when they talk about, you know, the crime we were talking about, that it was in the Midwest and it was in the Southwest. And a lot of it happened. The reason that you learned so much about in the 1930s, granted there was the Dust Bowl, which just further took the Depression and made it even life almost unbearable for those Americans who had to live through it. But you had the state borders of Oklahoma and Kansas and Missouri. That was a huge area of crime because you could literally go from one jurisdiction to the next, and they couldn't chase you.
And that it really had been started from the Civil War, even after the Civil War. And so I guess that was sort of a passing of an era in a way that it was the beginning of a new era.
But today, looking at the economic climate of today, it's nowhere near what it was in the Depression. But we had the big bag Wall Street and the big bad bankers. Let's not give them raises. I mean, the attitude of the public against those who have worked the system and who somehow have survived, it seems to me that public animosity that we have today was similar to the public animosity that existed in the
30s. That's right, a similar breed of populism. And as it turns out, I think, we'll see a similar response politically, not in terms of support of, Bonnies and Clydes, but in terms of reasserting the role of the public sector in assuring that we move forward in a way that benefits all Americans.
The public perception, by the way, of Bonnie and Clyde primarily were robbers of gas stations and drugstores. They were not big bankers, robbers. And as Brian Burroughs suggests, they were sort of pikers. They were bottom feeders, and they were also extremely violent, where some of the bank robbers, including John Dillinger, were not terribly violent.
I'd follow up on Bob's point, Bruce. You'll notice there's billions of dollars in the stimulus package for law enforcement agencies. And that's not a coincidence. The groups that were in Washington pushing for more money for police agencies were making the direct connection between the mood of the country during an economic downturn and an increase in crime. So clearly the law enforcement agencies, which are now vastly more sophisticated than they were back in the time of Public Enemies, they understand the connection between economic downturns and upticks in crime, and they've made a political response to that.
Let's take a telephone call. Let's go to Kevin, listening to us in Boise, Idaho on KBOI. Go ahead.
Hey, good evening, guys. Bruce, I really enjoy your show every Sunday night.
But, thank you.
Given your history of the show, I wanted to get back to a thing you said earlier about Frank Church and,
sure,
and his hearings and all, and I just would like to clarify. I think that man is more of an icon probably on the East Coast than he would be here in his own home state. I know he's long since passed, but I would say if you polled our listeners here in Idaho, probably 75% to 80% find that he did more damage on on the church hearings to the security of America than he did good to this country.
Mm-hmm.
We looked down upon him and wished that he was not associated with Idaho.
Very interesting. Well, again, just to put it in context for those around the country, Frank Church was, I believe, a two-term or possibly three-term senator from Idaho eventually?
I believe he was. I mean, I'm a little young compared to back when I didn't vote for the man, but I was too young for that. But, yes, he served quite a period of time. Idaho has changed since then, and, I just don't think he represents where we are today in Idaho.
Well, the one thing that I always found interesting, because Frank Church really he really burst on the scene, he gave the keynote speech at the 1960 convention that nominated John Kennedy in Los Angeles. That's how he became somewhat of a national figure, and maybe, as you suggest, maybe a darling of the East Coast media. It happened at that time. Again, he ran a couple of times representing the state of Idaho. But one of the things, because he was primarily a liberal, he was a member of the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, and certainly one would think that he would have been aggressive in trying to root out any abuses by the Central Intelligence Agency, which he was. But what appeared to me that it might be a reason why that might have played well back in Idaho was that he was also very concerned about government abuses of wiretapping, looking into investigations that might have been going with maybe right-of-center groups back in Idaho or groups that certainly favored, the Second Amendment. And that was at least part of the rhetoric that he articulated, trying to, I guess, be a national senator, maybe with liberal persuasions, and yet try to get reelected back home. Does any of that make sense? I know, Bob, you've got a comment, but I want to get Kevin's response first.
Of course.
Okay, Bruce, if I may on that, bringing it to modern day, we look at what's going on with the possibility of Cheney and what's happening in the most current events. Let me ask you this, or let me put this out to your guests. How many Americans can you show us have been harmed by what either Cheney or Bush did in the last 8 years? How many of them have been thrown in prison incorrectly? How many of them have been harmed by what we all claim are these horrible things? All we want to do is protect Americans from people who want to put our wives in burkas and cut our heads off.
Kevin, stay on the line. I want to let Bob and our guests respond to what you have to say, but we do have to pause for some spots. Stay right where you are in Boise, Idaho, one of the most beautiful states in the United States, and we'll be back with you when we continue from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and we go to Bob Creamer, who's got a comment for Kevin in Boise, listening to us on KBOI.
Kevin, I would think that people who live in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana who really care about their individual liberty would be impressed by the need to restrict government from intruding into their lives through wiretapping, through unwarranted surveillance through any of these kind of means that that we've been seeing the Democrats in Congress pursue in the last little while. And I would add, I mean, when you talk about people being harmed by the Bush administration in general, I mean, this war has been a disaster for lots and lots of families in America. The economy has been a tragic disaster. I mean, I don't think we have to go too far to find millions of Americans who've been harmed by the administration one way or the other.
Kevin.
May I respond? Okay.
You may.
What I'd like to say to that is basically I think that what you find in Frank Church was he, you know, what he may have done may have had good results in the United States as far as American citizens. But I truly believe that American citizens have a higher right, a higher responsibility, and a higher, you know, the Constitution has a higher answerability to us than it does the whole world, you know, the people outside. I think that what Frank Church did was to hurt us internationally more than he did, you know, our security internationally more than he did nationally.
In what way?
Well, you know, I'm sorry I'm not as well studied up as I ought to be on it. I've heard a lot of these things, and I'm not going to go into them unless I was more
okay.
More rehearsed on them. But I have to say that he has done damage to our international security. And
the one thing that did come out of that, and again, this is something that we alluded to earlier in the broadcast, and it was in 1974 and 1975. It was really the height of Frank Church's, in stepping into the spotlight with the Church Committee investigations into the abuses of the CIA, which really started in the public. A recitation of those problems began in December of 74 rather, with the revelations of Seymour Hersh on the pages of the New York Times. This talked about the massive wiretapping, domestic spying, looking in on being able to open phone records, and the story grew from that revelation. What followed when the investigation began, which is why once you started an investigation, if you really want curious investigators, once you start an investigation, you really don't know where that investigation will lead. And where the church investigation led was it got into a recitation of the CIA actively engaged in foreign assassinations. That certainly would not play well on foreign soil. You had the use of the relationship between the CIA and organized crime. They were hiring organized crime to be the hit squad for the CIA in assassinating people. That certainly was not a pleasant thing, especially when at the same time there was the other arm of the Justice Department was fighting the mob. On one hand, you're fighting the mob. On the other hand, you're in bed with them. So those revelations certainly, I think, when they became public, I think the reaction was people were startled at the actions of their government. Then what happened? It went too far. Then ex-CIA people began to write books like Victor Marchetti. And in the writing of his book, he would name names. He would name CIA station chiefs all over the world. And some of them began to be assassinated. And then public opinion completely turned against Frank Church, totally against Frank Church and anybody that questioned the actions, even the abuses, of the CIA.
Yeah, and Bruce, if I may, I think that a lot of it now, if we look at it now, it's a different world than it was then. And we now have people within our country that mean to do us harm, as was testimony of 9/11. And a lot of what the Bush administration may have been doing was trying to gather intelligence upon those bad individuals within our 50 states and the limitations put upon them by the church hearings and by the new regulations and rules put out by that is probably the most restrictive thing and the most damaging thing. I have no qualms listening in
checking up on and doing all sorts of intelligence upon those people who are here from foreign countries or those who are here who do us harm.
And I believe that you speak for the masses. I think you really do, and that's one of the reasons why I think when Republicans hear the Democrats talk about this issue, I think they're smiling. They're smiling because I believe they don't think this political capital
is made there. Most Americans want our agencies of government to abide by democratic values around the world, and they should, because our national security depends on people's view of us around the world as to whether or not we stand up for the values we allegedly do, espouse, or whether we're hypocrites. I mean, our standing in the world plummeted so much under George Bush that a lot of what he did basically were recruiting posters for Al-Qaeda and the people who hate
Nick
us.
Jensen.
Let me tell you what I think. What most Americans want in this case is to think that and to know with some degree of certainty that the intelligence gathering capabilities and the national security of the United States is handled properly by professionals who run those agencies. If sufficient cause exists to look into what was done in the past, then the Democrats in Congress, the Obama administration, they ought to investigate. If there isn't, then they ought to stop talking about it on the front page of the New York Times, and let's get forward with the full array of issues on the national plate.
On that note, we're out of time. That was Nick Jensen. He is was our Republican. He still is our Republican. Bob Cramer also joins us. He is the Democrat, and he is one of the progressive thinkers in the country and author of the book. Give me the name of the book again.
Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win.
And also joining us this evening, Barbara Iverson. She is on the journalism faculty of Columbia College. Her expertise is Twitter and Facebook and all the new media and also citizen journalism, letting people know what's happening in their communities. Also, our thanks to Brian Burrow, author of the book Public Enemies, who joined us for a portion of our broadcast this evening. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz, Kate Shepard, and the ever-popular Ben Stewart for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.